The band Talking Heads started playing New York punk clubs in the mid-70s, and as rock critic Ken Tucker has written, the band came to symbolize New York new wave at its naughtiest. Their initially terse, squawking, demonic sound summed up all that was eccentric and anti-commercial about the lower Manhattan scene. Talking Heads is still together and has become one of the most innovative bands of the past decade. My guests are the band's drummer, Chris Franz, and bassist, Tina Weymouth. They're married and have two children. Since 1980, in addition to their work with Talking Heads, they've had their own band, Tom Tom Club, which had a couple of dance hits. Last winter, Tom Tom Club released an album called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom, and this is the opening track. Franz and Tina Weymouth, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe to us why you formed this group.
One day we woke up and we found out we didn't have any money in the bank, and so we decided better get to work. And this is because even though the Talking Heads was doing really well, we had gone on the road with a band of 9 people or something like that, and we were traveling in airplanes everywhere and staying in fancy hotels and things like that, and we did a very successful tour which made no money, in fact almost put us into the hole. And so David was doing this thing called the Catherine Wheel on Broadway, and Jerry Harrison was doing an album called The Red and the Black, a solo album, and Tina and I said to each other, we better think of something to do. And we went to a friend named Chris Blackwell, who owns Island Records, and he said, I'll give you a chance that you can make a single, and if the single does well, then you can make an entire album. And we thought that was a nice, fair offer. And so we made the single, and I think it went to number one in 7 countries. It was called Wordy Rapping Hood, and it was a prototypical rap song, or homage to rap music, which at that time, we're talking 1980, was still a new and, as you would say, fresh type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then that led to an album, and then that led to a second album, and then Talking Heads got real busy and with movies and tours and things like that, and so there was no time for Tom Tom Club anymore, but now Talking Heads is like a band that makes an album every other year, so we got loads of time for the Tom Tom Club, and we're I guess you could say we're pretty much starting over like a new band.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about how you first got together, how Talking Heads first got together. You were both students at the Rhode Island School of Design in the 70s when when you met.
And, that's correct.
And also when you started playing together. What was the balance in your lives between art and music? Did you see yourselves heading in more visual art directions or music directions when you were in college?
Well, I was always doing both. I actually performed at the World's Fair in 1964 as a child. I was a handbell ringer. That's pretty funny, isn't it? And I loved that, you know, and I always loved the stage and performance. And but at the same time, I was studying art at the Corcoran. This was in Washington, D.C., and one of my teachers was Mark Rothko, who's just about my favorite painter in the world. And I was always doing both, and I think that's true for Chris as well. Wasn't it, Chris?
Yes. I started playing music when I was in, I guess, the... second or third grade, something like that. I started off, I didn't have English handbells at my school. We had flutophones. We started off on the flutophone. And one thing led to another, and I ended up in the playing drums in the school band, you know, marching in the football games and the Memorial Day parades. And then something happened. The Beatles came out, and every kid that could play music was started forming groups in their basement and playing Beatles songs and Venture songs and, you know, Dave Clark Five songs and Louie Louie and stuff like that. And this was a continuing interest, although I never really believed that I could actually make a living playing music, especially rock and roll. It seemed to me that was a different breed of person than what I was. Like, that was somebody who grew up in Memphis, you know, or Liverpool, or in the 60s, San Francisco, you know. I was living in Pittsburgh and practicing in my basement, and the chances seemed pretty remote that I would become a rock star. Uh-huh. To me. Well, and one thing led to another, and I went to college, and Tina and I met David Byrne, and we started playing together, at least David and I did in a band, and that later became the Talking Heads when we moved to New York.
Yeah, we wrote a song together in our studio called Psycho Killer. David came to us with some lyrics. He said, I've been approaching people and they won't help me with this because they think it's too morbid a subject. So we said, well, we'll help you. We understand what this is about. He said, I want it to be sort of like Alice Cooper. And so we wrote that song
This is true. He said he wanted it to be like Alice Cooper.
So this is how you first met with him, when he approached you to write the song?
No, actually, I first met him a couple years before that, when we were freshmen, and he was panhandling and playing the violin with a friend of his who played the accordion in front of the school refectory, they called it. He did this routine where he had a little bird perched on the bow of his violin. You may have seen that in cartoons, but this was in real life. And you know, we formed a little band called the Artistics, and we would play at the Valentine's Day ball and events like that.
So so David Byrne asked you both to work with him on Psycho Killer. What did you each contribute to it?
I think Chris contributed a verse, and I contributed a bridge and part of a verse.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't we play the record?
Sure.
This is from the Talking Heads' first album. This is Psycho Killer. Psycho Killer, and my guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth. You know, it's such a great record, and one of the things that's really striking about it is that you've got this almost dance-like beat with this really nervous vocal. it's this great combination.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about Talking Heads, though, you know, especially in the early days, it seemed like an odd grouping in a way. You know, this rhythmic beat and a really nervous singer on top of it.
Yeah, well, everybody always said, oh, you want to be in a band, you've got to be different. So having been trained as artists, we sought to be different, and we also sought to work within the limitations of our playing abilities.
Well, let's talk about the limitations of your playing abilities. Tina, when you started playing with the Talking Heads, you had barely played much bass before.
I had not played bass at all. I had taught myself to play guitar and flute, and of course, I was an English handbell ringer. And I had sung, you know, in school, you know, chorales and stuff, but it was a new thing, but then I just did what every, you know, kid does when they want to start a band. I got my amp, I got my bass guitar, and I had a car. And so I was in, you know, and they had approached many bass players, and they just took one look at Chris and David, and they said, oh, you don't look right. You don't wear platform glitter shoes, and you have short hair. And so I said, well, look, you know, train me. Actually, it was Chris who really kind of pushed it.
Was there ever any objection to Tina playing, since she was a real newcomer to bass? Any dissension in the band about it?
The band at that time was just me and David. So until Tina joined, and so he said, "Yeah, we'll give it a try," something like that, and we did, and. You know, once in a while, David and Tina would have a little argument about something, or a big argument about something, but it was never anything that was irreparable. And, if anybody thought that she couldn't do it, clearly they were wrong.
But Tina, let's get back to what you were just saying, that you were the girl in the band. Now, usually a woman in a rock band is, I don't know whether... they're sometimes forced into it, but frequently it's this like sex goddess image or earth mother image. But you really had neither of those images in the band. I remember seeing you in 1978, and you just stood there and played, and everybody in the band was dressed in a t-shirt and jeans, as I remember. But there was no special woman of the band image that you cultivated.
No, I was trying to avoid that because...
We're working on that now, though. We're getting the woman thing together here.
I was thinking that it might be nice for women to see a woman who was just doing her bit, you know?
It was, by the way, very nice.
And I thought it was nice that I wasn't up at the front.
Right, so you are up at the front now. Are you changing your image for that? This is in Tom Top Club we're talking.
Yeah, I guess we are. For one thing, I like to see people really have a good time. And so I know that if I'm fronting the band and I don't move around, that means everyone else, as what they call supporting players, but they're really just as important, everyone else can't move either, because then it doesn't look good. And so so now I'm very, very physical so that they can be very, very free, you know, to improvise, to act spontaneously. I always appreciated performances by James Brown, by Iggy Pop. Their way of showing their love and generosity for the public was by behaving in a very physical manner. So that image has changed. I'm no longer the young, classy admiral's daughter, would-be debutante. You know, I think now I'm a little bit closer to being one possessed at times, but I think that it's still not sexual, because I always hated that wimpy thing of girl bands, and I didn't like the masculine image either. I didn't think that was appropriate for women or natural, and I didn't want to do anything that felt unnatural.
Well, you know, you mentioned the sexual thing. I think a lot of times bands play off of any sexual energy they can generate between each other, and whether it's, you know, the guitarist and the bass player together, or, you know, a singer and the guitarist or whatever. And here you are in the band, actually married, and from the times I've seen Talking Heads, there isn't any of that sexual interplay. It's straightforward music.
Right. We avoided it, the sex thing.
We have the sexual interplay after the show.
I think we were avoiding it because we were trying to find our own niche, you know, in music. And if you look around, you're still laughing. That's great.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot, Terry.
If you look around, you can you see that most of the music that's selling today is music that successfully merchandises sex on television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really too much to do with music. But Talking Heads, we always wanted it to be about something larger than just about sex.
Tina, you described yourself as an admiral's daughter, a would-be debutante. Chris, I think your father was in the military also, wasn't he?
Yes, he's a retired general.
When you first got started with Talking Heads, you were playing at places like CBGB's, where it was like the center of the punk scene. One of your first tours was with the Ramones. And I was wondering what kind of affinity you felt with the punk bands that you were grouped together with.
We felt that we were on the outside looking in, and that we weren't part of the mainstream, and these other punk kids weren't either. In fact, we were in an interview for Punk issue number one, and we were the first to say, we have no heroes, you know, we don't think you have to be a technical virtuoso in order to play and to sound good. So that we shared with all the punks was the idea that the art is in the delivery and in the, you know, the message, and it's not necessarily that you have to, you know, get to Carnegie Hall in order to get your point across. And it was a very nice statement, too, that was being made, which was that anybody can do this. If you've got something to say, you can get up and do it.
Chris, how do you think Talking Heads has changed over the years musically?
Well, we've made these quantum leaps from time to time. At the moment, we haven't played together for over a year.
Right.
So I don't feel real great about that, but I have to tell you, the next time we get together, it's going to be a situation where we practically have to learn to play all over again. But what happened was we started off being really raw and really raggedy, but we played with great feeling, and somehow we got over on our feelings, because our feelings were maybe a little bit. How should I say, undisguised by the usual trappings of show business. And then one day we realized, hey, we're a lot better now, and we started to be able to. We added Jerry Harrison for one thing, and so we became a quartet instead of a trio, and we made a big leap ahead. Like, our sound got a lot better, and our confidence was better as well. And we sort of stayed on that plateau for a couple of years. And then we did an album called Remain in Light, which more or less changed the way people, at least in our sphere of influence, thought about music, about popular music, that is. In other words, we incorporated a lot of elements that were not to do with rock and roll. But we kept a lot that were. So it was kind of like an African rock and roll, I hate to use that word, fusion, but it was a melding of different influences. And it was a dramatic quantum leap again for us, because it kind of took things to the next phase, as they say. But by the time we did that this tour, which became the movie Stop Making Sense, we had refined our technique and also increased our, like, all singing, all dancing performance, so that it was really happening.
Did watching yourselves and Stop Making Sense, the movie, have a big impact on you? I don't know how much you'd seen yourself perform before.
Huh, that's a good question.
Yeah, it had a big impact on me in that I could now understand why people were saying, "Oh, that was a great show. That was a great show." Because a lot of times when you're up there playing, you might not feel that great. Like, you might even have the flu or something like that. But you have to go on, and particularly from a drummer's point of view, you're seeing the show in reverse, sort of. See everybody's backsides,
right.
You know. So it was very exciting for me to see how it built from the beginning to the end. And it was nice.
Well, it's always a shock, you know, because you know what they say, my face I don't mind it, for I am behind it. It's the others in front that I jar. So that's always kind of a shock, you know, especially because, you know, as being a woman, I'm sure you can understand this. There's, you know, you grow up as a little girl, you think, well, one day you're going to grow up to be a princess. And somewhere along the way you find out, oh, I'm not going to be the beautiful princess. And I learned, you know, that I was going to have to work really, really hard. I imagined myself as having to support myself, that I would never marry. I really said, you know, I'm the ugly stepsister. I have beautiful sisters, by the way. I'm kind of the ugly duckling of the family. And so, in a weird way, maybe I didn't sit back and wait for people to court me. I was.
She may be ugly, but she sure can cook.
Yeah. It is a shock to see yourself on film. But what I tried to do was see, well, am I doing the right things? Am I generating warmth, you know, towards the audience? And I enjoyed being part of something that was larger than myself. I enjoyed being part of that large band and feeling that I was watching that band just as much as the audience was. I was enjoying it like it was a show for me, too.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Sure
thank
thing.
You, Terry.